Blog Talk Radio.
Guest tonight who's recently been to Haiti, and he'll share with us his experiences. And now, without further ado, here's our host, Wild Bill.
Hello, Starla. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Well, it's been one of those weeks where I wished I'd been home instead of being out here on the road. But, you know, it just seems like, you know, we go through things in life sometimes. You're like, wow, why does this happen to me? And it sort of fit in with my thoughts for the show tonight. First thing I want to be sure and do, I want to say welcome home to Gabe and the Smith family, and I want them to know that we haven't forgotten them during the trial that they've been going through, and want them to know that we love them and they're always in our prayers. And also, Sister Sheila in Illinois, we would thank you for calling and listening to the show, and you're constantly in our prayers And we thank you for the inspiration you've been to us and calling in. And just know that we never forget you. And one of the things that's kind of going on with this week with me is sometimes I wonder, why do bad things happen to good people? And I get to looking at things, I'm like, you know, why? You know, and but the first thing I do is I take a microscope and I look through my life, well, have I done this, 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 and this? And, okay, maybe I need to do better on this, 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 and this. And you start moving in that direction. Sometimes it seems like it doesn't make things better. And the bad thing is, and I hope none of you are like this, but I'll be the first to admit that when I see friends and other people going through, you know, bad times, sometimes I put that same microscope to them, you know, wanting to judge them. I wonder what they're doing wrong if all these things are happening. And one of the things that I've learned through time is that you don't have to be doing something wrong. And one of the things that people love to quote the scripture, all things work together for the good for them that love the Lord, that are the called according to his purpose. And that's a real good scripture. I love that scripture when everything's going good. But when things are going bad, I tell you what, there's been a couple of times if I'd had a gun handy when I'm going through a hard time and people get to quoting that scripture to me, I just would like to shoot them, you know, because you're like, you know, you just, your mind can't wrap around the concept that, you know, this is happening for our good when things are going bad. And, you know, whether it's us or our family, you know, when things are going bad, when there's a trial or tribulation, it's one of those things that it gets our undivided attention. You know, it's a major point of focus. But one of the things I've noticed is that we are, and I think it all mankind is this way, but it may just be me, but it seems like we're really quick to forget. You know, you go through things that are bad, and then when things are going good, you just kind of forget about it. And I was thinking about 9/11. Unless I take time to really stop and think about that day, it doesn't really have any meaning to me. It's a real aggravation if I'm trying to get through the airport with all the extra security and everything. And you think about Katrina, and you're like, yeah, that's yesterday's news. But there's still, you know, hundreds and thousands of people that are suffering from what happened there. And then we have this Haiti. And it just, these things, it's kind of like out of sight, out of mind. And I don't want my life to be that way. And I've shared with all of you before with this program, is I'm looking for things in my life to get closer to God. And that's where we get to looking at different things with this show. And so I really pray that, you know, that we all as a group can try to do that. But I just want to say again that I'm thankful to all the people that call in and listen to our show. If you have any questions or anything after our speaker is done, then what you can do is just press 1. That puts you up on the queue, and then Starla will identify you by the last 4 digits of your phone number. And we'll have you on. And our guest speaker tonight is not just our guest speaker. It's my friend and my pastor. And I really appreciate him and all he's done in my life. And, Starla, I'm going to go ahead and turn it back over to you. And you can go ahead and set up everything for our guest speaker.
Well, it is with great pleasure that I introduce our special guest tonight, mine and Bill's pastor, Reverend Jonathan McElhaney. He has been the pastor of Life Change Ministries in Franklin, Tennessee for 6 years and was the Tennessee District Youth Pastor for 9 years and presently is a licensed professional counselor who provides on-site counseling for businesses. And he recently went to Haiti, and I'll let him share with you his experiences there. Brother McElhaney, we are so appreciative of you speaking with us tonight.
Well, you're welcome. Appreciate you having me on the program. Exciting program. I did go to Haiti recently, and it was quite an experience, as we would all imagine. Hear a lot of the reports in the news and things coming out of there after the disaster, and kind of as Bill was mentioning there, there's been 2 or 3 other kind of big events going on in different parts of the world, even since the earthquake in Haiti, so things do kind of get pushed a little bit into the background, but since the earthquake, now it's been a few months now, and they're in kind of a second phase there where I was. I was selected through the agency I work with to be one of the volunteers that would go and be a part of a mental health support team to work with and through Project MetaShare, which is a it's an organization through the University of Miami, the Miller School of Medicine there. There's a couple of doctors that kind of started a program to help the Haitian people with medical services even back in the 90s. So they were already a known resource and a known entity, I guess, to the Haitian people and government, being a non kind of governmental organization and just coming in to provide medical care and some clinics and some other things, some fresh water, and I think even some help with an orphanage or two. And so they were selected in the immediate aftermath of the earthquake. They were the ones kind of tagged to set up a field hospital, which ended up being at the airport there in Port-au-Prince, which is kind of a central location in that city. And so within, I think, 2 days afterwards, there were some medical staff loosely pulled together. One of the doctors with Dr. Barth Green with Project MetaShare, who's one of the founders of that, and then also some others that were down and had been flown down right away. And there were some pretty crude and rude, I guess, circumstances there at the very beginning. Trucks were pulling in with four or five people at a time, kind of dumping them off there and going back. And just the immediate aftermath, you can just imagine how overwhelming that was. And even for those that were trying to provide just some, you know, immediate intervention medically to those that were affected and impacted and not having what they needed. And so they're having to resort to just some pretty basic measures and a lot of amputations and so forth just to be able to deal with everything coming in, and weren't able to, you know, choose the options that we would, you know, maybe normally do with a patient that was injured. You'd have two or three options before you would go to maybe the last option. So it was pretty intense, but as things continue to evolve, actually a former basketball, NBA basketball player, Alonzo Mourning, was instrumental in helping the Project MetaShare team get some tents. And they actually bought the tents from the person that I guess he was a contact liaison for, and had those were flown down on a cargo plane right away. And so within just a few days, week or so, they were able to set up more of an operation there, a medical kind of a hospital in tents, kind of a MASH unit, if you remember that series and had seen any of those programs. That would kind of give you an idea of what it was like in the kind of the beginning. But things have progressed along, and they've continued to provide medical treatment and care. The field hospital there now is kind of in what they are calling a second phase, and then we'll transition into more of a third phase, which will be more of a long-term kind of rehab, rehabilitation, and those aspects of a lot of the care that's needed now that some of the immediate aftermath has been dealt with. And so they also are the best medical option and facility in Haiti. This field hospital is. So the ongoing injuries, accidents, health crisis that some of the Haitian people are experiencing, if they can get to this hospital and there's room, then they're treated or seen there, just with the ongoing daily life things that happen to individuals, motor vehicle accidents and other things. So they're still providing a lot of care and treatment. I was selected among, other health, mental health professionals across the United States that have been trained in crisis work, intervention, as along with disaster mental health services. And so was deployed there for a week, Saturday through Saturday. and MediShare, they have other medical staff and volunteers, doctors, surgeons, registered nurses, other physical therapists, other medical staff that all volunteer and come down in these kind of deployments, a week or a week, 2 weeks at a time, and basically staff the field hospital there for that period of time, and then the next team comes in and things are kind of passed off. So it's really amazing that they're able to provide the kind of hospital setting there they're able to provide with the qualified staff on just really a purely volunteer basis. So it's amazing. The chief medical officer, whoever's in charge, will change and rotate each week with the new volunteers coming in, and there's a little bit of an overlap so they can keep some continuity of care. But so that's just kind of some background about what's going on there. On the, I guess what you'd call the compound, it is kind of a gated compound with security, and so they can provide some structure. There's several tents set up, large tents. They even have a kind of double glass doors on the ends, although it's tent everywhere else. You walk in and out with some wood platform, walkways, and gravel around. And then inside the tents, it's a wood floor that's been kind of built out, and cots that are just side by side with ropes running along where IVs might be hanging from some of the ropes there and other things. A lot of some of the medical equipment's just sitting on the floor and things being run around. All their power is being supplied by big generators. They do have a solar-powered water filter system that's providing some clean drinking water to the hospital there. There's an adult, what they call an adult unit. It's an adult tent that can probably hold close to 100 people, and that's just side by side all the way through. That tent is divided into kind of different sections, kind of their med-surg unit, if you're familiar with medical treatment, your general medical floors, and then it kind of moves across in different rows, and then they have a rehabilitation area kind of over to the far right. So they do have it organized, and each area is numbered and lettered A1, A2, and B2 in each rows, and then they have kind of a nurse's station, tables, and supplies up at the front, and so they're able to function fairly well as a hospital. Then next to that tent, that adult unit, then on the other side there's what they call the pediatric tent or unit, and inside that tent there are kind of sections that are basically tarps that are kind of sectioning off parts of the inside of that tent where there's a pediatric kind of medical care area on the right when you go in. There's also a little OB area with some of the things for maybe expectant mothers and all, and a little area on the right, and then medical supplies and things to the left. And then as you kind of go on in that tent, there's a what they call a neonatal unit for the babies, and there were four in some of the incubators and the medical care that they had in there. Also, that tarped area included kind of a pediatric ICU also. So they call it a PICU and a NICU. And on the other side, they had an ICU that had three or four beds in there that they treated some of the adults in that ICU section that was a part of the children's tent. And then in the back of that tent, you go through a couple more doors, and that was the operating room. So they had a full operating room set up in the back of that tent that was completely sectioned off with doors. And they were providing, you know, surgeries and doing a lot of things there. And there were several plastic surgeons, some orthopedic surgeons and others that were there and doing work on those that needed it. There's a lot of injuries from all the earthquake and all the things that happened. Kind of one important probably insight is Haiti is on an island, and the island is shared with the Dominican Republic on one side, and Haiti is on the other side, and that's all one island. And so, in general, the people there, probably their greatest threat would be more of a hurricane type of disaster. And so, in Port-au-Prince there, being close to the water, A lot of their structures are built out of what some of the things you may have seen through the news media, blocks and cement and concrete and things. And they're built up, of course, being in the city, up several stories, some of them. And so that's well and good, maybe, and really good if you're having a hurricane, because it'll withstand some of the winds and can get up above some of the water if there's flooding things. But in the event of a earthquake like happened, which was not really expected, those kind of structures will crumble, which obviously they did. One of the hospitals that was kind of operational there in Port-au-Prince collapsed in that earthquake. And so there was a community hospital, kind of semi-operational. One volunteer, I didn't go there, but had been there the day before, that came to the field hospital, said that she had been out in a clinic way further out into the country, and it was really basic there, and then was at the community hospital, and that it was really unorganized, and there was medications in some rooms that had expiration dates of the 1990s on them, and they had never been opened. And so some of that kind of information gives you a little idea of the lack of, or, you know, organization and just structure and things really being at a level we're used to here. And so she came to the field hospital and was commenting that she'd been out in the field and out in some of the rural area clinics, then was at the community kind of hospital that was partially operational, and then came to the field hospital, and she was talking about how the field hospital was so much more structured and organized, and just being there, some of the staff there felt like it wasn't, because it's even below some of the standards we have here, but it still is much more than what they would have there otherwise. So that just kind of gives you an idea of maybe what kind of levels of medical treatment and care are even available there. If this field hospital is the best they really have access to, that kind of gives you a picture there. But so the part of their problem is you have all the people that are living in what they call the tent cities, and anywhere there's space and room throughout the city of Port-au-Prince, there are tents set up in those open areas. There's a park area. It's some kind of a city park with a large statue of an important individual, obviously, in their culture. But all you can see is that statue sticking up, and the rest of the whole park, similar maybe to some of the parks in our larger cities, is filled with tents, and people are living. They just, you know, anywhere there was a space in the city, there goes a tent. And so they're side by side. And the people that obviously lost their homes and places they were living were damaged or destroyed, were displaced, and they're all out in the tent cities and living in tents around the city. In addition to that, it's kind of compounded as far as the displacement's almost doubled, because you have another group of people that could go back to their homes but won't, because of fear that, you know, the earthquake and what happened could happen again. And there have been some aftershocks, a few of those that has added to that fear. And so not only do you have those that don't have a place to go, but then you have those that have a place but won't go back because they're fearful. So they're sleeping out in tents as well. So it's kind of doubled the challenge there as far as the tents and those living in tents. So there's a lot going on there. The U.S., United States has been a good neighbor to Haiti. The Haitian people really look to America as a friend and know that we do offer a lot of help there and have. A lot of what the Haitian people will tell you is there's some disconnect with their government there. And I think the things that maybe we heard on the news about supplies being there at the airport but couldn't get those to different places, having to respect the sovereignty of that country, we can see things need to be done and want to do it as a country helping out, but you have to have permission to do those things, you know, in an international type of effort. So, and then based on things I heard from some of the Haitian people, just trying to understand more about kind of their situation, is there is some disconnect between their government and its operation and really being able to try to help raise the people Just kind of they're left kind of where they are, it seems like, from some of their reports. So, but a lot of the people have a desire. They want to learn. They want to be educated. There's no public health education system there. So in the long term, you know, how far can they go or how high can they rise without, you know, much education, the education that's available? There are some schools and things they have to pay for their children to be able to go, and if they can do that or not, it's always an issue. So there's a lack of some of those kinds of things. Some of the military was there. One officer had stopped by and brought some stuffed animals to some of the children and some candy, M&Ms, packs and things. He was getting ready to be finish his deployment, and he had been up in some areas where you probably heard in the news where they're actually moving these whole regions of people that have set up out in some of the outlying areas where it will flood when the rainy season comes, which it's already started, the rainy season has. And so they're having to move whole communities of people that have set up in tents up to higher ground. So the United States Army is there doing a lot of that and moving and helping to set up camps, reset camps and things. And he had been involved in doing a lot of that, those that would have been in real danger once the rainy season came. So a lot of good things are going on there. A lot of mission groups have been over there. We saw a lot of mission groups associated with different, I guess, ministries and religious organizations that were there. A pretty diverse group. There were some folks there from the Church of Scientology that were working to help get a child back that needed a special kind of surgery. You had other types of some of the Jehovah's Witness faith. Some of their materials were, I saw a Watchtower Organization magazine in one of the tents with some of the family members. There were other, you know, of our groups that we know or think of as church group, faith groups, Baptists, other groups that had been over there. Providing services, some dental and medical groups were there with different religions here from North America. So there are a lot of people reaching out and going to help in through avenues that and connections that they have. So there's a lot going on, a lot of diversity in some of those groups. But the Haitian people are they're primarily Christian in their faith orientation. There's also a small slice of Catholic faith, and then there's a strong strain of voodoo type of perspective, even in those that maybe claim a Christian orientation or faith. So it's more like a lot of ways like it is here. There are interpreters that worked in that hospital. They were paid each day to be there and be available. And a nurse or doctor needed to talk to someone, they could just, you know, holler interpreter, and they're around in each facility available, just always available. So, and through some of what they would say and all people there, and they talked about being Christians and asked, you know, about being a Christian and so forth. And then they would talk about, yeah, well, kind of the sense you got was it's like it is here, people that claim to be something and then those that really try to practice, you know, what they claim. And so there's certainly a variation even there of those. But the Christian faith is the predominant faith. And even if they have some variations from that, most of them are very open to that, and it's a kind of a part of their culture. So they really do rely on that, and that aspect kind of will lead toward more of what I can share here too about my experience. I didn't really know me personally. I provide on-site what they call critical incident stress management services in the workplace and with organizations and schools following some traumatic events and difficult situations. And so I'm familiar with dealing with those kinds of settings and the needs that are there following crisis and disaster. So I kind of had, I guess, enough knowledge to know what I was getting into or would be getting into when I went there, being involved in, that I wasn't just chomping at the bits to go because, you know, it's going to be pretty heavy. So, but at the same time, you know, if you are trained for that kind of work and you can offer some value in some areas, then certainly the need is there, much more need than there is the resources and those to go to be able to meet the needs. So it was an on kind of thing and an off kind of thing, and then it came back on again. And so my personal experience was just praying about it and leaving it in the hands of God. And if it was meant to be, I would go. And if it wasn't, then I wouldn't go. Well, the door opened finally for good for me to go. So really just had an assurance, since I had personally committed that to the Lord as far as what I was going to be involved in and wanting to be, you know, more than just someone going to provide resources. I wanted it to be a part of a bigger plan, you know, that God could be involved in and could even go beyond what I might expect or be able to do and provide there through the agency I was being deployed through. So the door opened and got prepared and supplies. And a part of the field hospital setting there, and even the volunteers, is they have a volunteer tent that's set up next to the other two tents that has cots in it that are just sitting on the ground. They did get some extra gravel in there while I was there. If it rains very much, the tent would flood, and they would throw pallets down so you could step over some of the mud puddles and around and try not to knock somebody off their cot while you're doing that. It operates 24 hours a day, so there are people trying to sleep in there some during the day, and then at night the lights are out, so you have to have a little flashlights or headlamps and things. And so it's pretty basic. You really are camping. You have mosquito nets, and food is, there's no cafeteria there. They bring food on a truck in styrofoam containers and kind of set it out. And if you know it's coming, you might get it. If you don't and you're tied up, you may not get something unless somebody sets one back. Some of the security staff, the other support, Haitian support workers there, along with all the volunteers that have come over. And there were other volunteers there, some from Aruba, other medical staff, some from Canada, one from Spain, another person there that had been studying in the United States in residency. So there were a few residency students there. So there were some other volunteers that were coming in to provide the medical services. But so the food situation, all that, there would be those there were wanting to get their hands on that, and the patients that were in there, and usually there were two or three family members there with some of the family or some of the patients. So there were several to feed, and so had to bring food and supplies, and it's pretty basic conditions. And there was air conditioning in the all the tents run by the generators. The problem was sometimes the generators went out. So probably 3 of the 7 days I was there, for at least probably 6 to 8 hours, the generators were out in some of the adult tent. A couple of days there was no air in there. In Haiti, it got extremely hot. And then in the sleeping quarters, there wasn't air in there some too. So you just had to kind of deal with what was there and things you weren't used to, and certainly gets you out of your comfort zone. And so it's a huge transition, just leaving what we're used to and being dropped out there in that field hospital and just kind of roughing it. And then also seeing all the things that you see with the Haitian people and some of the very difficult circumstances there, experiencing, and certainly their health. And there were people that were dying, and babies even, and some children. And I think the one day there, probably our toughest day, we had about 5 deaths, 2 of them being children, and one baby, and then the other 2 being adults. So some of those circumstances, one patient that was brought in was had a stroke, some of the typical things that would happen here, and had some brain damage and just could not eat or drink and wasn't really conscious, kind of some basic body functions, allowed that patient to live for a few days, but then she died. And so the morgue there is a tent outside. There's no refrigeration, air conditioning, so families have to try to work something out to get the bodies of their family members within 4 hours, or else they're sent to the Haitian morgue, which is basically a crematory. They don't really have any other way to do anything with, you know, the bodies. And so there's a lot of just real raw basic things going on, and it's just the best that there is that's there. So, and then you're seeing children that are paralyzed and babies that are injured, and hydrocephalus babies coming that are brought in with really large heads that are just continuing to swell, and they are able to put some shunts in a few of those. And so there's just a lot of difficult things you're seeing there. And then when I got on the ground the first day, I was inside pretty feeling pretty much like a fish out of water. Didn't want to be there, and thought, what am I going to do here, and how am I going to help, make a difference? There had been some there already the week before, and they had kind of built some relationships and were able to go around and feel pretty comfortable. And now I'm there and not knowing what to do hardly or where to go. And then thinking that today, the day after you get there, it's your birthday, and you've got family and your children, and you're thinking of all those things. And so it's quite a transition to make. But I felt like it was a part of the bigger plan. And so as we do, we kind of just keep stepping forward and doing what we need to do. So I had a few tears and a few moments. My wife had sent a couple of cards for me on my birthday, which probably didn't help. I probably didn't need to get that sentimental and needed to be down there and focused. But I read one that morning, and that kind of brought out some emotion. And then that night I read another one. So again, it kind of reconnected me with home and some of the personal feelings that I had that really were secondary to what was our primary work there. We were there to work with children, their caregivers, to help identify some stress. Obviously, there was a lot of stress and anxiety, and even possible cases maybe of PTSD, to help teach some coping skills. They don't have a lot of education, so any kind of stress management or information about having traumatic stress and what some of the reactions are like around that, and just some of our normal natural ways of reacting to big events. Sometimes without knowing what some of that is, it causes a lot of distress as well. So good education is helpful in helping them know what resources are available. That's also a very difficult thing because there aren't very many resources to refer anyone to. Here, that's a huge piece in any kind of support working with anyone, is making sure they're connected to other good resources that they may need or could access. And there's really just not much. There was a local guy there named Frandy, who was a Haitian psychologist that had been working there and actually was kind of tagged to stay on each week. And he lost part of his family in the earthquake, his mother and father, and I think a brother and a sister. Yet he was there working each day trying to help others that were really in the same situation he was in. And so he was helpful in being able to provide some education and to be able to talk with patients when they were getting ready to be discharged, to really know maybe what was the best. A lot of times they're in a safe place at the field hospital. They're getting food, at least two meals a day, and there's a place to use the restroom and other things. And when it comes time to be discharged, a lot of them really didn't want to be discharged out onto the street and kind of fending again on their own. So there's a lot of challenge and anxiety and stress even for the staff, is just having to kind of do what you had to do and send people on their way at times. And so it was extremely difficult, some demands there. With some patients on ventilators that based on the demands of other patients and needs and where those patients were. They had to make decisions on taking out the events and letting patients die there at some point because they didn't have the room and space just to keep them on a ventilator or something long-term. Infection there is a pretty big challenge medically because of the conditions, and then there's nowhere to get antibiotics or medical treatment a lot of times except for maybe at the field hospital, and they were running low on some of those kinds of supplies, so they were having to shorten some of the antibiotic treatments and things to maximize what they could provide to more people, and just a lot of different challenges. I'm probably really sharing a lot of information bouncing around in a lot of different places, but back to my experience, I went there looking for something bigger, maybe that God would do beyond me going as a mental health professional, part of that team. Knew that would be valuable. They don't have those resources, don't have anything like that. So we worked to support the families, and through the interpreters, we would talk with the families and kind of give them someone that a caring ear and a caring heart that would be there, and then trying to provide some information to them about stress and kind of some of the best things they can do and help them explore what options and what supports they have that could help them cope and continue to deal with some of the ongoing challenges they had. And so we were kind of trying to connect things. The local Frandy, the local psychologist, was kind of working as a social worker, and we would connect him to different patients and their families. And we would also help the medical staff when they were trying to get information to the family, or sometimes things were having to be done so quickly that maybe the family didn't know or the patient didn't know exactly everything that was going on with them. And that can add a lot of stress if you're being treated and you don't really know everything that's going on. So we would take some time and make sure they had all the information and understood what kind of procedures were being done and what some of their medical treatment plans were and so forth. One example was a gentleman that he had a couple of pins that had been put into his lower ankle. He was probably in his mid-60s, and it had gotten infected, so he was back to the hospital, and his foot was swollen really large up to below the knee, and they were going to have to amputate his leg. The infection was so bad, and it had gone so far that was the best option to save his life and to physically get him to a place where he could be healthy again. And so I was called in to talk with him, make sure he understood, you know, what was going to happen with that. And you know, it was amazing, really. He understood and kind of got the picture and knew why it was necessary. And if it wasn't done, that the infection would spread and would end up killing him before very long, and if they did this, then the pain would be gone and his health would be back to normal, other than him having to adjust in how he was able to walk and move around, those ambulate and things like that. So after, you know, explaining that, he kind of laid back and just kind of nodded, kind of like, okay, you know, if this is what needs to be done, it's what needs to be done. They were really pretty resilient people, pretty able to go with what was, certainly wanted more at times than what maybe they could get or what was available to them, like anyone would, but they were pretty gracious and thankful and resilient in just dealing with things the way they were. And so another day I came back in and I was checking through that unit to touch base with a few people that I'd been connected with, and I heard somebody kind of holler behind me and wave at me, and it was him. It was the same guy that I talked to the day before, and he called me over, waved me over, and then he reached down and he pulled the sheet up, and he had had the amputation, and he was back into the adult unit, and he wanted to show it to me. So it was kind of neat in a way that, you know, you get connected and they value that support, and then once it was done, he's like, come on, and showed it to me and was smiling. I was smiling and got an interpreter, and we talked about it, and he was, you know, seemed to be pleased that he was getting, you know, health care there and medical treatment that was saving his life ultimately. And so simple things, but it meant a lot to them. But as I was working through the week, there was a team of chaplains. It wasn't long after I got there. Some of the workers there and their backgrounds involve other things. There was a logistics person that had been working there that was, I was told, was also a rabbi, and he had been working there for a couple of weeks. And I think through his connection with maybe some people back in the United States, they had made some contacts with Hope Force International, which is a, they provide a pathway for deployment and disasters a lot of times through the Salvation Army, but they train people to be able to work as chaplains, providing emotional, spiritual care in disaster-type settings. And by the evening of the first day I was there, kind of trudging through, trying to get adjusted, sweating, you know, just dealing with the circumstances, trying to catch a cot that wasn't in a puddle of water, and just trying to survive, and then start to get acclimated and oriented. And we had some debriefings and some briefings as we came in, and orientation to the facilities and all. And so we were going through all that. We ran into a gentleman and recognized him and stopped and said, "Hey, Chuck." And he looked at me really surprised, and he was surprised I remembered who he was. But he was one of the Hope Force volunteers that had been deployed there, along with two others that were working as chaplains in the field hospital there. And they had been in some of the trainings that we also provide, my agency, through the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation. We provide a lot of trainings on stress management and providing individual crisis intervention and peer support for those that work in emergency services, public services, and a lot of the principles and things are applicable across disciplines and professions. And so also along with the foundation, they have a pastoral crisis intervention course, 1 and 2, and an emotional, spiritual care and disaster course that the Salvation Army uses for a lot of their training, along with the Hope Force uses these courses. The American Counseling Association, American Association of Christian Counselors, has a Christian crisis responder and Christian crisis specialist kind of certifications they do, and they use these same courses. So they're kind of standards in training for people in this field. So our agency, my director is the chairman of the board for that foundation now, so we have a direct connection, and we provide a lot of trainings in the Nashville area for a lot of the emergency services and social workers, counselors, medical staff, military, police, chaplains, you just name it, nurses across the board, clergy, church, community, disaster ministry teams, and other groups. So these, to make a long story short, I guess, if I can, these guys and the gal that was there, the chaplains, had been in some of the courses that I had taught. They were actually students in there and were trained. I had actually trained them. And so right away there was a quick connection to them and the work they were doing there. And with the Haitian people being primarily a Christian people with strong Christian faith orientation, it was a good fit for them to have chaplains, to have Christian clergy or chaplain support, because that's where they were and that's kind of the values they related to. And it was extremely supportive to them to have that. So they had been working all week and had a lot of good connections with a lot of the patients, and had provided a devotional on the Sunday morning for the staff and out in the field there. And we're doing some things to provide some spiritual support in that operation. Well, they were getting ready to leave the next day, and we were overlapping on the deployment, and their team lead came to me the day that they before they were getting ready to leave, and he said, "Hey," he said, "you know, you can do this probably as much as any of us." He said, "We're leaving, and there's not going to be any chaplains here. We were just wondering if maybe you could be the chaplain here." And so I told him, "Well, you know, we'll see. I need to kind of think through this and make sure I'm sticking with some of the, you know, your assignments and being deployed as and part of this team, the psychology team, and you can't just choose to reassign yourself." So I said, "Let me just kind of see what I can find out, and I'll touch base with some of my my team leads, and we'll see kind of what can be done. Well, we just kind of left that where it was. I had my responsibilities to work with the psychiatric team, the psychology team, providing, you know, that support and stress management support, but there was also this need, and of course the Haitian people were really open and receptive to the chaplain's role in providing spiritual support, and that was very helpful, and it was seen by the doctors and the staff and others there, that being a very big benefit to the people. So the next morning they left, and then I was walking out of the tent, the volunteer tent, and my team lead, my psychiatric team lead, stopped me, and he said, you know, the chaplains were leaving, and they were, you know, I guess they had had some team lead meetings, and they knew that was providing some valuable support to the folks there. So he said, we've had some meetings, and I was just wondering if, and I think some of the other chaplains had probably shared the information that about me, that they knew I could do that kind of work as well. And so he came to me without me asking anything and said, you know, just wondering if you felt comfortable being a chaplain in addition to being in your role as a part of the psychology team. And so and he said, well, you know, you feel like you're qualified. And I said, well, yeah, I'm qualified. Here's my qualifications and licensed ordained minister. And I'm also, you know, a chaplain, and I train other chaplains and teach courses and da da da. And I said, well, I was just wondering if you could do that. And he said, I think it would be extremely appropriate. That's what we have need for here. And so filling these roles is a part of how we need to meet the needs that are here. And so just immediately got assigned to be a chaplain also for the field hospital, and actually became the chaplain for that whole next week for my time while I was there, providing that spiritual support along with some other sides of support. Sometimes when you're in crisis or disaster, the psychological and the spiritual get so intertwined, you really can't separate it. The distress of what's happened, the questions, why, God sometimes, and not really understanding things that don't make sense, that kind of go to your core and whatever your core beliefs are that seemingly are violated during those times. And for most of us, there is a faith core belief there of something. And so it's common for folks in those kinds of settings to have those questions and to be at that place and point where having some kind of spiritual support is extremely helpful. And so it's valued and it's seen across professions from some of my experiences, those that are willing to look at things and look at the value of what's there, they understand the value of the spiritual and religious benefits of a person's faith and so forth. So that's really not something you have to try to get over as a major hurdle with the people I've worked with, because they understand that. They may not practice or want to be a part, but they allow it and they want it to be there because they realize the value of it. So that was kind of that bigger picture and plan that began to unfold. I became a chaplain, and not just having my name, but having chaplain, and then being known as the chaplain and being called at different times to specific situations with patients who were losing family members, had lost a family member, being able to offer prayer to them and praying with them, praying with the man that was going for the amputation before he went, and beginning to function and offer a spiritual level of care along with the psychiatric side of things, and being able to blend them together when needed. And so it was really a wonderful thing. And as things moved along, another interesting thing happened while I was there. Hillary Clinton's chief of staff came to visit the field hospital to take a tour and see what was going on. I think the United States is looking at, and with her being Secretary of State, she's looking at some grant that might funding that might help them build some hospitals in Port-au-Prince and some other things. So they kind of opened the gates to more patients in the middle of the week. They wanted to be functioning at capacity when that tour came through for her chief of staff and others, so that they, you know, could show of the need that was there, and it really showed well. So things kind of ramped up. We got pretty overwhelmed. The ER is outside of the tent, just under tarps. They had beds set up on gravel, patients waiting on benches just under little canopies in the hot sun, waiting to be seen outside in the emergency room under a tarp. That's what the ER was. So we were running kind of runners, helping the ER physicians and others, filling gaps, doing a lot of other things that you do in those kind of settings when the need's there. Well, as I was asked to go to the supply tent to get some supplies for the ER doctor so she could kind of give patients some medicines and be able to maybe send them on their way that didn't need to be admitted and things could keep moving, as I went into the tent and sent, of all people, I was asked to go to get this one kind of medication. While I was in there, ended up being kind of led over to another area of the supply tent. And I can't remember why I went over there, but I started looking through some books, and I found a box of New Testament Bibles on the shelf. It had dust on them. And when I saw those, I thought, wow, this is something special. So I got the New Testaments out and thought, wow, here we have supplies, we have Bibles that can be given out. They were in French. The Haitian people speak French, or kind of a version of French called French Creole. And so that would have never been discovered without me and being sent to the tent, and then somehow ending up over on another aisle looking for supplies and finding that box of New Testament. So that was a further development I felt like was a part of this bigger plan that was at work. And so I guess for me, in that personal experience, I suddenly realized, hey, this bigger plan is unfolding here, and God has expanded my role here and my work here beyond what I thought would originally be being a part of the mental health team. Now I'm the chaplain here. I'm the main spiritual resource for everyone in this complex. I was called in the middle of the night because there was a mother in the PICU who was, she was singing, kind of praying to herself about the situation with her baby. They had taken it out of its little bed area and had it up on the table, and were having to manually vent the baby and intubate it, and the baby was basically, they felt like it was dying, and there was really nothing they could do beyond everything they were doing, and they just, the inevitable seemed to be there. So I had been on call the night before. Each one of us on the mental health team took a call each night. Well, it was the night after. I wasn't on call that night, but when the nurse came to the logistics tent to look on the call list, she looked on the wrong sheet. She looked on the night before sheet and looked and found my name as being the one on call. So she came in, and I was awoken about 2:15 a.m. in the morning, and said, hey, we've got a baby. It looks like it's dying, and we need you to come and help. And I was kind of a little bit groggy and said, well, I don't think I'm on call tonight. And she said, well, I don't know. I think you're the one they need. And I said, yeah, they must be, I must be the one. And so I was quickly just kind of trying to get oriented, and I just felt like suddenly there's a reason why I'm being called. And so I just got up and answered the call and went to the tent and ended up sitting down with the mother there, the young mother, as they were just working feverishly on this little baby, trying to keep it alive. And so she was kind of praying to herself, and that's why they wanted me as the chaplain to be there, and they found me, or they would have gotten a mental health person only if they'd gotten the right sheet. So things were working, and just while I was there, I was amazed at how God was just connecting things, and things were working to provide spiritual care there for those involved. So I sat down with the mother. The interpreter was there. We had prayer together. And after praying, you could just really feel a peace settle in on her. And the one of the unique things about the hospital situation there is there's no dividers. Everyone's kind of in the area they're in together. They're sitting side by side. Cots are side by side. Families are there with their family member, and they're sitting next to someone else, and they can look over, and there's nothing else to do a lot of times. So, you know, they're nosy, and they're wanting to hear what's going on with the next person, and it's just everybody's kind of in there together. It's just the way it is. There's not a lot of privacy. So the mother was basically sitting there watching them work on her baby feverishly, trying to keep it alive. And so that's when I was called in, sat down with her, and took her by the hand, and had the interpreter, and we began to pray, and I was praying for the Lord to intervene and to help the child, touch the child, and to give peace and just bring his presence and be there in a mighty way, in a real way. And there was a peace that came. The Lord came, and you could just feel it settle in. I could see the mother's face as it kind of, there were her countenance, some of the distress and all kind of subsided, and you could just tell she had received some of that peace and was settled some there, even though things were still very concerning. And so she sat there, and I sat there with her for a while, and about an hour had passed, and was just there. I went and got her some water and was just trying to kind of meet some of the basic needs. And it was kind of cold in there with the air blowing at night once the sun goes down, and she was a little cool, and I was finding the blanket and just doing some things that, and there weren't a lot of blankets. And then she started humming some songs, and I was just sitting there trying to be a supportive presence and with what they were doing with the baby. And I kind of sat between her and the baby where she wasn't just constantly seeing the distress of that, but let her view the baby at times, would move out of the way when she wanted to see what was, she would see what they were doing, and then she would lean back and kind of go back to kind of humming to herself. And then finally she started singing, and started singing a little chorus, and it was in French, and of course I didn't understand what she was singing, but so I started humming along, just trying to follow the tune with her, you know, to support her in what was bringing comfort and what she was feeling. I don't know what, she obviously had a religious background and understanding and valued that, and was singing something and singing a chorus. So I started humming. I wanted to support her, continuing to express that, especially at that time, and bring comfort. And so I was humming along. And after about a course or two, I started recognizing the tune of the song. And I said, boy, that's what that course is. And so I started singing the course with her in English while she was singing it in French. And I asked the interpreter what she was singing, and he said, it's something about the blood of Jesus. And I recognized the tune, and that confirmed it for me. She was singing, nothing can, what can wash away my sins? Nothing but the blood of Jesus. What can make me whole again? Nothing but the blood of Jesus. Oh, precious is the flow that makes me white as snow. No other fount I know. Nothing but the blood of Jesus. And to hear that sung in French, I can still feel the chills. I can still feel the moment there, the spirit and the connection and what was taking place. When I was singing with her, there was such a powerful presence of peace and the presence of God himself that was there in what was going on. And so we sang that chorus several times through, and she was smiling, and I told the interpreter to tell her I knew the song. I was singing it with her, and we finished singing that song, she was started singing a couple of other songs, and the only word I could recognize in the next chorus she would sing was Savior, Savior, and they have that kind of French pronunciation to it. And she would get to a certain part, and she would say, Savior, so I'd hum along again, and they continue to work on the baby and basically kind of put it back on the vent machine to try to sustain it and kind of had it fairly stabilized at about probably 4:30 about that time. And so things had kind of come to at least a pause there and calm. So I finished there with that support and finished my time and told her I'd be back, you know, later in the morning to check back. And the baby was back in its bed and they had the machine kind of operating again, but it wasn't at the right numbers and it still didn't look good. And so, but there was that experience that just when I went back to bed and was kind of laying there thinking about, wow, I would have never dreamed I would have been in Haiti singing a song like Oh Precious Is the Flow and the Blood of Jesus and There's a Savior that and be there to share in that and support someone from Haiti that I couldn't even speak the same language with, but yet there was a connection through her faith and what my faith is and to be used. And then so I left her a Bible, and that became one of the things I did as I carried those New Testaments around with me. And when a family member would lose a family member, I would make sure I gave them a Bible, and they were also appreciative of it. As I was leaving the supply tent with them that first day I found them, one of the security guys sitting at the door saw. He said, "What's that in your hand?" He's like, "Oh, he wanted one." And they really want more of the things of God, of faith. They really do hunger for those kinds of things. And you got to imagine in kind of the status they're living in and the way their life has been, they really do reach out to God and really do depend on Him. And faith is pretty strong even in the midst of what's going on. Another unique thing that happened was at night in the adult tent, one of the Haitian men would get a Bible, it looked like a Bible anyway, and he would start walking up and down the aisles of the tent. And this is something they did on their own, just the Haitian people, a part of their culture. And he would start saying things out, and then they would repeat a few things, and he would say another few things, and they would repeat something. And everyone all throughout the tent would kind of join in, and in a way they had a group devotion. And so he would say something, and they would repeat it, or they would say something back, and he would basically say it again, you know, now lift your hands. And they would be laying in their cots or sitting in the wheelchairs next to their family members or whatever, and so they would all lift their hands together at the same time, and then they would sing a chorus, and they all joined in. So they had open group devotions in the units there, and even in the pediatric side, one of them would go in there, and they would have a devotion time and read the Bible and sing a song, and the person would exhort a little bit. Basically, I didn't understand everything they were saying, but that's what I was told. So it was really unique. The first night I didn't know what they were doing. I had gone to bed, and it was about 10:30 or so, and you heard some loud kind of hoots and hollers coming from the adult tent. So we were checking into that to see what it was, and we found out, you know, this is something they did on a nightly basis. Of course, some nights, depending on the status of the patients and all, it might be a little more boisterous than other nights, but it was unique to go there and then to see that, you know, God and the things of God were such a big part of their lives. But yet, even with that being there, there was still a great need and there's still a great desire for more of the things of God. And they, like all of us, appreciated that and wanted God to help them where they were and to be there with them and to be that strength and help in the days that they had been facing in the days to come. So we also did some group family education in the evenings. We did some things they hadn't done there before, even with some of the other teams, as we announced it to all the families that were in each tent. We brought them all outside and set up under a canopy. We'd have 35 or 40 family members, and so they would open up with some general information about dealing with, you know, difficulty and the stress of what's going on in their lives. And then Frandy, the local Haitian psychologist, would talk to them about, you know, ways to deal with stress and how to try to find the positive and focus on things you can deal with. And he just did a great job. He understands their culture and examples and things. And so he did a great job on just teaching a lot of stress management and coping skills and some basic self-care when you're going through kind of things you're going through. And then as they finished that, I was called on to pray for the whole group and to pray for God's blessings and help and strength. And so that's what I did. And after coming back and kind of looking back over it, I would have never dreamed, I did not know. I felt like God would lead and guide in some special ways. And we prayed as a church family, my church, and of course Bill and Starla and others that prayed and were praying for me while I was gone, that the Lord would be with me and that he would bless and use me for his purpose while I was there. So when looking back now, I went as a mental health professional, but I ended up becoming the chaplain for the whole field hospital, going around praying with patients and their families and staff and praying for the whole group of people in the group sessions finding the Bibles and being able to hand those out. I never gave them to anyone that didn't want them. You know, everything was welcomed and always asked and respected everyone's, you know, where they were. But I would have never seen that part of it looking at it, you know, prior to. But now having gone, I can see, and then seeing how God was able to use me. I also made some contacts with another a minister from a local church there that came kind of to help and provide some chaplaincy type of assistance there, and he had been approved to do that, and a few others. And I had two requests from two of the workers there that were interpreters, and some of them were trying to go to the university and get an education, but yet work there some during the days. And they requested, the thing they wanted was a Bible, and they wanted an English Bible with the Old and the New Testament. A lot of the patients, whatever Bible they had, it might be one of the little mini New Testaments, a lot of the patients that were in the hospital would have a Bible laying beside them open. It was a part of kind of what they felt support from, and so it was common to see that throughout some of the patient beds in the hospital. But some of these individuals, what they wanted was an English Bible. A lot of them are trying to learn English, and especially the interpreters. One young man he said he had learned 4 languages, and he wanted to learn 10. His brother had learned 8. They had been raised by their mother, just kind of making it on their own. He was a really good help there, because some of the interpreters, like other workers, are just there to do their job and try to make money. Others were there because they wanted to serve their people also and be that link in their care there. So you did see some variation in that. But the ones that I connected with, they were wanting Bibles. That was the one request. They wanted the English Bible that had the Old and the New Testament. And then this minister from one of the local churches there, he requested Bibles. He said, we don't have very many Bibles. So I came back also with kind of a mission to be able to get Bibles sent down there in English for those that wanted those, plus this church and a couple other groups that wanted to have them to be able to give them out there. So along with all the other things that happened and the ways that God used me and had that plan all worked out in advance, it really is amazing to see what God will do when you kind of step out of your comfort zone, you take a risk, you kind of go beyond what you feel like, hey, there's others that can do that, or, yeah, it's important I go, but I have important things here, and, you know, but I put that back in the hands of God and said, God, if it's that important for me to go and it's on your priority list, then you'll open the door, and he did. And now I see why. And even the people I worked with on the mental health team were so respectful, and they seemed to be so impressed and influenced by me and other staff members there, to see someone who was a licensed mental health professional but also carried such strong Christian values and the spiritual aspects. And to see that I guess, in a genuine person in action and in someone that respected other people and tries to, as I always do, try to, you know, do that in a way that is real and is a blessing and a help to people. So it was an influence all the way around, just the ways that God led and used me there. And one of the other mental health professionals with me, he had his hands raised with me the last night we were there when we were participating in their devotion. And he doesn't really attend church or anything. He's from New Jersey, but just to see that, hey, there was such a, an open and a welcomed feeling and spirit and way that everything was unfolding and being done, that people felt comfortable joining in and being a part of it and felt the draw of the goodness of God that was going on through all the work that was being done. So, wow, I would never dream that I'd been the main chaplain, praying for people, handing out Bibles, making contact with people. I would come back to the States now and then get more Bibles and more of the Word of God together to send down there. I've not even launched that part of the project yet here, but then to see all the other contacts that were made and to just be used in that way, it was amazing what happens when you kind of step out there and take that risk with God, and you don't always know. And I got there, and I wish I wasn't there. I wrote in my journal the first night something about, you know, da-da-da-da, here's what happened, I wish I wasn't here. You know, that's how I felt. But I just kept on going, and the next day, and got up, and we started to connect with some of the people, and then we got connected to the purpose and the mission, and that was the people there. We were there to serve them. We were there to support them and support the staff that was there to serve them also. And so, you know, it didn't take too long to find that mission and purpose. A lot of stress among the staff, not having this or that and working long hours and all that, but we all had to work on refocusing. Here's our mission. Here's our purpose. This is why we're here. Yeah, all these other things come along with this kind of a deal, but you could keep rising above it by going back to the mission, and that was to serve. And I'm amazed, and I'm still marveling at the way that God was able to use me in that role that I was in, and how he expanded it into the way that he had planned and was able to be used in such a wonderful way and be such a wonderful influence. So I'm just thankful. I feel blessed. I feel fortunate. Just so many things come back, trying to decompress from being there and being so involved in their lives and coming back to life here and all that we have. It certainly gives you another perspective, you know, on where you are and kind of what you're doing in life and what's really important. I think I've been a little bit better father since I've been back, and at least I've been praying to be that, and a little bit better worker and husband and, you know, pastor and other things. Just, you really do get a bigger picture, and some of the things that we get really worked up about sometimes, you kind of have another perspective that changes some of that, and it's not as important or doesn't seem as big when you've seen some of the things that you see there. But anyway, I've talked quite a bit here and tried to cover shotgun style, I guess, different aspects of the work there. And so then any questions that you might have about any of that, I'm open to that, and then whatever else the program has here at this point.
Brother McElhaney, I want to say that I'm blown away, because I don't know if you remember the conversation before you left. I was asking you if our organization had any missions or missionaries that were there, and was wondering if you would be able to have any contact. And you work in an occupation that it's a professional field, and there has to be a separation between your professional duties and your spiritual life. And I understand that. I ran into it some when I was in law enforcement. And so, you know, your job is there, and you know, and we kind of discussed that you had to be the professional, you know, when you went there, but you really didn't know what you were going to be doing. And then just how God took control and made it to where it became your mission, as you say, became a spiritual mission, as well as the focus with your business. I'm just, I hadn't had a chance to talk to you since you got back, so I'm blown away. And I do want to thank you for being on the show. Starla, did we have anyone in the queue that had any questions?
Not with questions, but I'm sure everybody was hanging on with to every word.
It's it's sometimes we get so wrapped up in our little.
Oh, we do have a caller.
Okay.
Charlene, wait.
Yes, I just want to know if the baby made it.
Oh yes, that let's that hang. The baby did not make it. The baby made it through half of the next day, made it till the next afternoon, and it died. It was, yeah. And we had another, the lady with the stroke died at the same time. I actually, that was another unique thing, and I walked in to, her name was Tan Grace, I won't forget that, but some of her grandchildren that were there. She had a son that was trying to get back from the States to get there before maybe she died. But I walked into the tent and was checking back through with some people, and I walked up to her bed just to kind of see her. And one of her, I guess, granddaughters was there that hadn't been there. Some of the grandsons had been there. And so when I walked up, she took her last two breaths. This elderly lady, Tan Grace, that had the stroke. So that happened at the same time the baby also died at the same time. And I didn't even know it. I got caught up in that because I was the one letting the staff know there and then there with the family and providing some support to them. And so I didn't know that the baby in the other tent had died at the same time, and so that was going on there. So I never got to, other than stopping back in the next morning, I didn't get to be with her, and I really wanted to, especially after what had happened before. But, you know, there things are happening so fast sometimes, and things are happening in a lot of different places at the same time. So we had, that was the day we had, I think, five different people die there, so it was a tough day and really busy with them opening up for more patients and having the site visit, and so there was just so much going on. But yeah, the baby didn't make it. So we did have a baby in a box. That's what we kind of called it, the baby in the box that was dropped off at the hospital, and it was really, you know, you have all the negative things, you know, the things that didn't work out and, the difficulty on all that and then even the deaths. But then we did have some really neat things that happened, too. This baby in the box was brought in. It had probably at least four major strikes against it, that the reason it shouldn't have made it, and it did. It was hypotensive. It was gray. Was, you know, the medical team even didn't think it had any chance, and it made it. It pulled through, came back, and was alert and feeding, and just, it was really kind of a miracle that it was able to come back from where it was when it came in the box. So that was the baby in the box miracle. And another young man, a teenager that was in a coma for 4 days, woke up one morning and was kind of groggy that morning, but by noon was fully alert and awake and was up walking, taking some walks with physical therapy. So there were some kind of neat things going on too, good stories, good outcomes, you know, that we certainly held on to those and celebrated some of those.
Have you found the cost for what it would cost to send a Bible over there yet? So, you know, we could announce it on our show, and people wanted to send donations to the church, they could do that?
I haven't. I do know there are some award-type Bibles that have an Old and a New Testament in them that, you know, are not just the really flimsy paperback, but they have kind of that, I guess, man-made cover, but it's a little better. And They're around $7, I think. You buy them in bulk. But they have the words in red, I think, in them. And so they're decent, but yet they're still a kind of a an award-type Bible, but fairly decent. Probably somewhere around $7, $7, $8 a piece.
Yeah, that's not a lot. So anybody that would like to contribute and help to that, we'll get Starla to give the address for the church at the end of the program here. Starla, we got anybody else that's got any comments or questions?
No, but your mom is on. She's listening. Your mic
Did you have
on.
Anything for us, Blog Talk Mom?
Well, I just, I am in awe of everything that Brother McElhaney has shared with us. One of the reasons I didn't say anything, because I was wanting to cry through most of it, Brother McElhaney, you did an unbelievable work. And to share it with us tonight, I can't think of anything in the world I needed to hear any more than the anointed testimony that you've shared with us tonight. And I volunteer $100 for the Bibles, and I'll be sending it first of the month. So I think that's a wonderful thing. I also know the Gideons sometimes will come alongside and
yeah,
help with the with Bibles. But I just hope you write a book. I really hope you put this on paper. It is, it's one of the most inspiring stories of the hand of God just having his way with his child, because you were willing, like you said, to come out of your comfort zone. And it just, it was just beautiful. And thank you so much. Thank you, Bill, and my sweet little Starla, for the program. And it was just, I pray that everybody got to hear it tonight, because it was just, it was so real. Brother McElhaney, you know, sometimes we hear and we read, and, you know, there's just so much that you can't even hardly wade through it. But when you hear it come from a heart that was so yielded, and you were so real, and you didn't try to make it glamorize, it was horrible. But in the midst of that horror, God had his way. And it's just beautiful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I want to thank you too, Brother McElhaney. I know you have a very busy schedule. You have the church. You have your job that you do. You got two beautiful small children, and you have another one on the way. And so I want to thank you so much for taking the time to share this with our listeners tonight. And you're, as you know, you're a blessing in my life that's second to none. I really appreciate you being my pastor and being my friend.
Well, I appreciate you too, and just thank you for allowing me to be a part of the program. And I don't always get to be a part of it, haven't yet, but with the kids and the schedule here with their bedtime and all, it's great to be able to be a part and share that, the story. One last thing I'll mention to you, the next morning after that night call incident with the mother and singing the song with her, I shared that with the mental health team when we met the next morning and just told them, you know, how I sang this course with her, and there was a connection. It was such a powerful thing. And then later on in the day, one of the mental health team members came to me and she said, you know, when you were telling about you in the mother singing and what happened, she said, I just felt chills all over my body. She said, I just felt something when you were talking about that. And so there were, you know, little things, but God was at work. It was awesome. And just me sharing that experience with my mental health team and then them being influenced, it was, and then coming back later and saying something, you know, that was unsolicited like that. Just let me know again, hey, it may not have seemed like, you know, there was a great miracle, which I would have loved to seen that. I certainly prayed several times for God to, you know, perform a miracle for those patients and the people there, you know. But what I thought, you know, and wanted didn't happen, but there were some other really powerful and wonderful things happening too.
Right.
So
And I want to
compliment
Sister McElhaney for being so brave to let you go.
Yes, yes.
There's another story to that. I was at prayer meeting Monday night after Brother McElhaney had left, and she came in, and I mean, you talk about a woman praying for her husband, but she also let us know that she was a little agitated because he got separated from his phone at the airport, and she hadn't heard from him since he left on Saturday other than a brief message that, you know, he was there and what was going on. And so, but she had us all, boy, she was making sure we was all getting in there and praying for her husband, that he'd get back home and he'd be able to get in touch with her and everything. And and people just forget that, you know, family life goes on. You know, it's still, yeah, it's, you're part of your family's missing. You know, it's not mm-hmm. there. And so it's not just what you did on that part, but it's also the struggle of the family back home. And so many times we get so wrapped up in our own little world, we forget, you know, that there is a bigger picture to things going on. And I wonder how many opportunities is before all of us where God wants to do just a little something, and we just don't open our eyes to allow him to do that. And I know within myself, mm-hmm. I want to be more open for those things in God. Charlotte, do we have anybody else, or did you have anything before we go off the air?
Just an awesome, awesome testimony. When Brother McElhaney came back from Haiti and started telling us that, I just was mesmerized. I mean, I had to hear every word. It is incredible. Every word.
Yeah. Can you give the address for the church?
It's 1316 Huffines Ridge Drive, Franklin, Tennessee, 37067. Life Change Ministries.
So anyone that would like to help contribute, you know, for sending Bibles over to Haiti, just send it to the church there, and you can make a note that it's, you know, for the Bibles in Haiti, and mm-hmm. we'd appreciate your support.
Yeah.
Did you have some else for Mac Honey?
Every penny will go, you know, for that, so we'll make sure of that. And the cell phone deal, you want me to give a minute or 30 seconds on that?
Sure, go ahead.
That was another miracle, really. My agency got me an international world edition of BlackBerry cell phone, which was I had so much support to go from my agency. I just knew God was going to do something because it was really unusual. Anyway, they got me this BlackBerry world edition cell phone to take with me. They rented it. And they were going to pay the bill at $289 a minute, I guess, and whatever the text and data would be if I emailed or whatever. But they wanted me to have it. My director said, I want you to have this. Also, going to Haiti put me in front of the board of our organization, letting them kind of know what we were going to be doing. And so there were things happening through all that that it was also, I think, not by chance. But when I got on the plane to fly to Haiti and I got off the plane, I had tried to rest a little bit, and my cell phone on my belt clip was a little uncomfortable, so I took it off. Well, I left the plane, and we were trucked to the kind of the compound where the field hospital was. When I got there, I realized I had left my phone on the plane. And so this is as I'm arriving. So that added a whole lot of stress to just trying to get started and make that transition into what I was going to be doing. That was a big part of that, trying to get, you know, there and just starting off on the wrong foot and feeling horrible about that, and then being cut off, not having any communication back to home, and then, you know, thinking about this $400 cell phone, and, you know, here my agency went to all this trouble, and, you know, and so I did everything I could do. I called, I got to the logistics tent. I ended up getting a ride from the logistics team back to the airport. I fought my way through 10 lines of security when I couldn't understand them. They couldn't understand me. I'm trying to get back to the plane. I fought through that, got out to the tarmac. Actually, I was trying to get to this Vision Airlines counter. They kept pointing me back and back and back. Finally, they sent me out these doors, and I walked out the doors, and I'm out on the tarmac. I'm like, where's Vision Air? And there's two security guys there, and they're like, it's, like, flown away. There is no ticket counter. There's nothing. I mean, so I was like, oh, no, it's gone. So then I had to fight my way all the way back. That was the start to my trip trying to get the ride back and get through security and try to explain what I was doing, and it was just a madhouse. But got back to the deal. I called my wife, said, you know, call my work, let them know what's going on. I'll just have to deal with it when I get back, da, da, da. Well, all that was going on. Finally got over that. That was tough, but that was a part of me trying to continue to focus on what I was supposed to be doing, and I'm kind of shooting myself in the foot as I'm going. But when I got back on the plane to come back home, I went to that seat where I sat. We tried to call their headquarters, and the answer machine was in French, and, you know, I exhausted every option I could, so I thought, well, it's gone. But they checked with their lost and found in Miami, and there's nothing there. So they were saying it's gone with the wind, no pun intended. And got back on the plane to come back. I went straight to that seat. I kind of had faith. I thought, well, God, you can, maybe you could have got it stuck in the pocket or beside the seat. It can, and I'm going to find it. You know, just anything's possible now after what's happened down here. So I went to that seat. I looked all around. It wasn't there. So I went on back and sat down. And as soon as I got set down, the stewardess said, is there a Jonathan McElhaney on this flight? And when she said that, my heart leapt within me because I knew I wasn't going to be singled out for any other reason. Then there was something that, you know, I just knew. And so I raised my hand. She came back. She said, is there something that you're missing or that you lost? I said, yeah, BlackBerry World Edition cell phone. She pulled it out of her purse and handed it to me.
Wow.
She said, I found this last week when you got off the plane, she said, and I just kept it with me, she said, because I wanted to make sure you got it.
Wow.
She said, I was afraid if I turned it in, you may not get it back. There's anything could have happened. So she said, I just kept it for you. I started kind of dancing in the aisle and jumping up and down. I told the mental health team with me, we all kind of got pretty close. I said, hey, if she's bringing my cell phone back here, if that's what that is, you're going to see me shout. I got up in the aisle and kind of hooped and hollered a little bit and had that brand new cell phone put right back in my hand. She was that guardian angel that watched over it and took it as a personal responsibility to keep it for me. So that was another miracle, really, of unique God things at work. So I was able to come home and give that back and not have to tuck my tail and pay the price.
As your dad says, you're from the head and not the tail. That's so funny. Well, anyway, I want to thank you again for being on the show, and we've kind of ran over a little bit tonight. For those on the computer, they weren't able to hear, but thank you, Brother McElhaney, so much, and
thank
your wife for allowing you to take the time to be with us tonight. And next week, the show is going to be on the topic of what would be a current-day Good Samaritan. You know, we all know the Bible story of the Good Samaritan, but what would it mean for us in this day and time? What is a Good Samaritan? So I want to pray God bless each and every one of you. Thank you again for listening to the show, and we'll be back with you next week. God bless you. Good night.
Night.